This is Audible.
You are listening to Christian Audio's production of The Road Back to You, an Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery by Ian Morgan Cron and Suzanne Stabile. This book is read by Ian Morgan Cron. This audio recording was produced in 2016 by Christian Audio, which owns the copyright. No portion of this recording may be reproduced for any reason without prior written consent from Christian Audio. This edition, issued by contractual arrangement with IVP, originally published in English as The Road Back to You, An Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery, copyright 2016 by Ian Morgan Cron. All rights reserved. Please visit christianaudio.com, facebook.com/christianaudio, or twitter.com/christianaudio to offer your impressions of this work and to explore additional titles. Grant, Lord, that I may know myself, that I may know Thee. Saint Augustine. I dedicate this book to my wife Anne, my daughter Kaylee, my son Aiden, my daughter Maddie, and my great son-in-law Paul, with great love. And to my dogs, Wendell and Ella, my beloved companions, who sat at my feet as my ghostwriters. Suzanne dedicates this book to her husband Giuseppe, with love, and to her daughters Joey and Jenny, and her sons Joel and BJ, who are their hope. Chapter 1, A Curious Theory of Unknown Origin. One Saturday morning, my cell phone rang at 7 a.m. Only one person in the world dares call me at that hour. "Is this my youngest son, Ian?" my mother said, pretending to be unsure she'd called the right number. "Yes, it's me," I said, playing along. "What are you working on?" she asked. At that moment, I wasn't working on anything. I was standing in the kitchen in my boxers, wondering why my Nespresso was making end-of-life noises and imagining all the sad ways an early morning conversation with my mother could end if my coffee maker broke and I was deprived of my first day's cup of coffee. "I'm thinking about writing a primer on the Enneagram," I said, gratefully watching a black stream of coffee love fill my mug. "The sonogram?" she shot back. "No," I said. The anagram?" she said, firing a second round before I could stop her. "Enneagram, Enneagram," I repeated. "What's the Enneagram?" she said. My mother is 82 years old. For 67 of those years, she has smoked Pall Malls, successfully avoided exercise, and eaten bacon with impunity. She has never needed glasses or a hearing aid, and is so spry and mentally acute, you'd think nicotine and inactivity were the keys to a long and happy life. She'd heard what I said the first time. I smiled and continued with one of my Enneagram elevator speeches. "The Enneagram is an ancient personality typing system. It helps people understand who they are and what makes them tick," I said. There was a long, utterly airless silence on the other end of the phone. I felt like I had been suddenly flung wildly into a black hole in a far-off galaxy. "Forget the angiogram. Write a book about going to heaven and coming back," she said. "Those authors make money." I winced. "They also have to die first." "Details," she purred, and we laughed. My mother's tepid response to the idea of my writing a book about the Enneagram gave me pause. I had my own reservations about the project as well. When my grandmother didn't know what to make of something, she would say it was novel. I suspect that's how she'd describe the Enneagram. No one knows for certain when, where, or who first came up with the idea for this map of the human personality. What is clear is that it's been a work in progress for a long time. Some trace its origins back to a Christian monk named Evagrius, whose teachings formed the basis for what later became the seven deadly sins. and to the desert mothers and fathers of the 4th century who used it for spiritual counseling. Some say that elements of the Enneagram also appear in other world religions, including Sufism, the mystical tradition within Islam, and Judaism. In the early 1900s, an undeniably strange teacher named George Gurdjieff used the ancient 9-pointed geometric figure, or Enneagram, to teach esoteric subjects unrelated to personality types. Now, I know, if I end the story here, I could add Harrison Ford and a monkey and have the backstory for an Indiana Jones movie. But wait, the plot thins. In the early 1970s, a Chilean named Oscar Ichazo happened upon the Enneagram and made significant contributions, as did one of his pupils, an American-trained psychiatrist named Claudio Naranjo, who developed it further by weaving insights drawn from modern psychology into it. Naranjo brought the Enneagram back to the United States and presented it to a small group of students in California, including a Catholic Jesuit priest and educator on sabbatical from Loyola Seminary named Father Robert Oakes. Impressed with the Enneagram, Oakes returned to Loyola, where he taught it to seminarians and priests. It soon became known among clergy, spiritual directors, retreat leaders, and laypeople as a helpful aid to Christian spiritual formation. If its sketchy origins weren't enough to spook the mules, there is no scientific evidence that proves the Enneagram is a reliable measurement of personality. Who cares that millions of people claim it's accurate? Grizzly Man thought he could make friends with bears, and we all know how that turned out. So what led me to believe that writing a book about an archaic, historically questionable, scientifically unsupported personality typing system was a good idea? To answer this question, I need to introduce you to a tall, bespectacled monk with knowing eyes and a tender-hearted smile named Brother Dave. For 10 years, I served as the founding pastor of a church in Connecticut. I loved the people. But by year 7, our average Sunday attendance was running 500 people, and I was running out of gas. It was clear the church needed a pastor with different gifts, someone who was more a steady-at-the-helm type than an entrepreneurial spirit like me. For 3 years, I tried everything short of surgery to transform myself into the kind of leader I thought the church needed and wanted me to be, but the project was doomed from the start. The harder I tried, the worse things became. I made more missteps than a guy running through a minefield wearing clown shoes. There was no shortage of confusion, hurt feelings, and misunderstandings by the time I left. For me, the end was heartbreaking. Following my departure, I felt disillusioned and confused. Eventually, a concerned friend encouraged me to see Brother Dave, a 70-year-old Benedictine monk and spiritual director. I first laid eyes on Brother Dave in his black habit and sandals, standing on the grass-covered roundabout at the end of the monastery driveway, waiting to greet me. Everything from the way he used both his hands to grasp mine to the way he smiled and said, "Welcome, traveler, can I make you coffee?" told me I'd come to the right place. Now, there are monks who pass their days in their monastery's gift shop selling votive candles and giant wheels of homemade cheese, but Brother Dave isn't one of them. He is a wise spiritual director who knows when to console and when to confront. During our first few sessions, Brother Dave listened patiently as I rehearsed the litany of miscalculations and mistakes I'd made in my ministry that in hindsight baffled me. Why had I said and done so many things that seemed right at the time, but looking back were clearly senseless and, frankly, at times hurtful to myself and others? How could someone have that many blind spots and still be allowed to drive a car? I felt like a stranger to myself. By our fourth session, I had begun to sound like a lost, half-crazed hiker looking for the path out of a forest while loudly debating with himself how the heck he came to be lost in the first place. "Ian," Brother Dave said, interrupting my meander, "why are you here?" "I'm sorry," I said, as if someone had just tapped me on the shoulder and awakened me from a daydream. He smiled and leaned forward in his chair. "Why are you here?" Brother Dave had a knack for posing questions that on the surface seemed almost insultingly simple until you tried to answer them. I looked out the leaded windows lining the wall behind him. Through them, I saw a giant elm, the tips of its branches bending toward the earth under the weight of the wind. I struggled to find words to express what I wanted to say, but couldn't. The words that came to me, finally, weren't my own, but they perfectly captured what I wanted to express. I don't really understand myself, for I want to do what is right, but I don't do it. Instead, I do what I hate, I said, surprised a guy who always had trouble remembering his cell number could pull Paul's words from Romans 7 out of his hat. I want to do what is good, but I don't. I don't want to do what is wrong, but I do it anyway, Brother Dave responded, quoting a verse from the same chapter. For a moment, we sat in silence, considering Paul's words as they spun and glimmered in the air between us like motes in a shaft of sunlight. Brother Dave, I don't know who I am or how I got into this mess, I confessed, finally breaking the reverie, but I'd be grateful if you could help me figure it out. Brother Dave smiled and sat back in his chair. Good, he said. Now we can begin. At our next meeting, Brother Dave asked, Are you familiar with the Enneagram? A little, I said, shifting in my seat. But it's kind of a crazy story. Brother Dave winced and laughed as I told him about my first encounter with it in the early 1990s when I was a graduate student at a conservative seminary. While on a weekend retreat, I came across a copy of Father Richard Rohr's book, Discovering the Enneagram, an Ancient Tool for a New Spiritual Journey. In it, Rohr describes the traits and underlying motivations that drive each of the Enneagram's 9 basic personality types. Based on my life experience and what I'd learned in my training to become a counselor, Rohr's descriptions of the types were uncannily accurate. I felt sure I had stumbled on an amazing resource for Christians. On Monday morning, I asked one of my professors whether he'd ever heard of it. From the look on his face, you'd have thought I'd said pentagram. The Bible condemns incantations, sorcery, horoscopes, and witches, he said. None of which I recall being mentioned in the book. And, he said, I should throw it away immediately. At the time, I was a young, impressionable evangelical, and though my gut told me my professor's reaction bordered on the paranoid, I followed his advice, except that whole part about throwing the book in the garbage. For bibliophiles, this is the unpardonable sin that grieves the Holy Spirit. I knew exactly which shelf held my dog-eared copy of Rohr's book in the bookcase in my study. It's too bad your professor discouraged you from learning the Enneagram, Brother Dave told me. It's full of wisdom for people who want to get out of their own way and become who they were created to be. What does getting out of your own way entail, I asked, knowing how many times I'd wanted to do just that in my life, but didn't know how. It has to do with self-knowledge. Most folks assume they understand who they are when they really don't, Brother Dave explained. They don't question the lens through which they see the world, where it came from, how it's shaped their lives, or even if the vision of reality it gives them is distorted or true. Even more troubling, most people aren't aware of how things that helped them survive as kids are now holding them back as adults. They're asleep. Asleep? I echoed, my face registering confusion. Brother Dave briefly gazed at the ceiling and frowned. Now he was the one searching for the right combination of words that would unlock the answer to a seemingly simple question. What we don't know about ourselves can and will hurt us, not to mention others, he said, pointing his finger at me and then at himself. As long as we stay in the dark about how we see the world and the wounds and beliefs that have shaped who we are prisoners of our history. We'll continue going through life on autopilot, doing things that hurt and confuse ourselves and everyone around us. Eventually, we become so accustomed to making the same mistakes over and over in our lives that they lull us to sleep. We need to wake up. Waking up. There wasn't anything I wanted more. Working with the Enneagram helps people develop the kind of self-knowledge they need to understand who they are and why they see and relate to the world the way they do, Brother Dave continued. When that happens, you can start to get out of your own way and become more of the person God created you to be. After learning his afternoon appointment had canceled, Brother Dave spent extra time with me to talk about the importance of self-knowledge on the spiritual path. How, as John Calvin put it, without knowledge of self, there is no knowledge of God. For centuries, great Christian teachers have said knowing yourself is just as important as knowing God. Now, some people will say that's just feel-good psychology, when actually, it's just good theology, he said. For a moment, I thought about all the Bible teachers and pastors I knew who had done things that had blown up their lives and their ministries, often on an epic scale, because they didn't know themselves or the human capacity for self-deceit. They studied and knew the Bible inside and out, but not themselves. I thought of how many Christian marriages I'd seen fall apart largely because neither spouse understood the inner splendor and brokenness of their own souls. Then I thought about myself. I had always believed I was more self-aware than the average person. But if the last 3 years had taught me anything, it was that I had plenty of growing to do in the self-knowledge department. Brother Dave looked at his watch and slowly stood up. I'm away leading retreats for the next month, he announced, stretching to get the blood flowing again after our nearly 2 hour seated conversation. In the meantime, dust off your copy of Rohr's book and reread it. You'll appreciate how he looks at the Enneagram more through the lens of Christian spirituality than psychology. I'll email you the names of a few other books you can read as well. I really can't thank you enough, I said, rising from my chair and slinging my backpack over my shoulder. We'll have plenty to discuss the next time we meet, Brother Dave promised, embracing me before opening his office door to let me out. God's peace! I heard him call down the hallway after me. Since I was on a long overdue 3-month sabbatical with more time than I knew what to do with, I took Brother Dave's advice to heart and threw myself into learning the Enneagram. For weeks, nearly every morning, I walked to the coffee bar at the end of our block and pored over the books he had recommended, taking notes in my journal. At night, I gave a report of everything I was learning from the Enneagram to my wife, Anne. Intrigued, she began to read up on it as well. In that season of our lives together, we had some of the richest, most meaningful conversations in all of our marriage. Do we really know ourselves? How much does our past interfere with our present? Do we see the world through our eyes or through those of the children we once were? What are the hidden wounds and misguided beliefs we pick up as kids that continue to secretly govern our lives from the shadows? And how exactly would wrestling with questions like these help us better know God? These were some of the questions I eagerly lobbed at Brother Dave when he returned from his travels. Sitting in his office, I described for him a handful of the many aha moments I had experienced while studying the Enneagram. "How did you feel when you discovered your type?" Brother Dave asked. "Well, it wasn't all hats and horns," I said. "I learned some painful things about myself." Brother Dave turned around and grabbed a book off his desk and flipped to a page marked by a red sticky flag. "To know oneself is, above all, to know what one lacks. It is to measure oneself against truth, and not the other way around. The first product of self-knowledge is humility," he said. "Well, that sums it up pretty well," I said, chuckling. "It's Flannery O'Connor," Brother Dave said, closing the book and placing it on his desk. "There's not a lot she doesn't sum up well." "And Anne," he continued, "what's it been like for her?" "One night she read a description of her type to me in bed and she cried," I said. "She's always struggled to find words to describe what it's like to live inside her skin. The Enneagram's been a real gift to her." "Well, it sounds like you're both off to a good start," Brother Dave said. "It's been incredible. What we've learned from the Enneagram so far has already begun changing the way we think about marriage and friendships and parenting," I said. "Well, just remember, it's only one tool to help you deepen your love for God and others," Brother Dave cautioned. "There are plenty of others. What's important is the more you and Annie grow in self-knowledge, the more you'll become aware of your need for God's grace. Not to mention, you'll have more compassion for yourselves and other people." "I want to read you this Thomas Merton quote I found," I said, leafing through the pages of my journal. Brother Dave rubbed his hands together and nodded. "Ah, Merton, now you're swimming in deep waters," he smiled. "Here it is," I said, finding the page where I had written down the quote. I cleared my throat. "Sooner or later, we must distinguish between what we are not and what we are. We must accept the fact that we are not what we would like to be. We must cast off our false exterior self like the cheap and showy garment that it is." I slowed, surprised by the knot in my throat that was making it hard for me to continue. "Go on," Brother Dave said quietly. I took a deep breath. "We must find our real self in all its elemental poverty, but also in its great and very simple dignity, created to be the child of God and capable of loving with something of God's own sincerity and his unselfishness." I closed my journal and looked up, flushing from embarrassment at how emotional I had become. Brother Dave tilted his head to one side. "What was it Merton said that moved you?" I sat quietly, uncertain how to answer. The monastery's church bells rang outside, calling the monks to prayer. "I feel like I've been asleep for a long time. But maybe now I'm beginning to wake up," I said. "At least I hope so." Whenever I said something Brother Dave thought was significant, he'd pause to close his eyes and reflect on it. This was one of those times. Brother Dave opened his eyes. "Before you go, can I pray a blessing for you?" he said. "Sure," I replied, sliding forward in my chair to get close enough for Brother Dave to wrap both his hands around mine. "May you recognize in your life the presence, power, and light of your soul. May you realize that you are never alone, that your soul in its brightness and belonging connects you intimately with the rhythm of the universe. May you have respect for your individuality and difference. May you realize that the shape of your soul is unique, that you have a special destiny here, that behind the facade of your life, there is something beautiful and eternal happening. May you learn to see yourself with the same delight, pride, and expectation with which God sees you in every moment." "Amen," Brother Dave said, squeezing my hands. "Let it be so," I whispered, squeezing his hands in return. Brother Dave's blessing made a difference in my life. Over the years, my work with the Enneagram has helped me to see myself with the same delight, pride, and expectation with which God sees me in every moment. Learning and now teaching the Enneagram has shown me something of the crooked timber from which my and other people's hearts are made. The self-understanding I have gained from it has helped me put an end to a few childish ways and become a more spiritual adult. I'm certainly not there yet, but now and again I sense the immediacy of God's grace and for an instant catch a glimpse of the person I was created to be. And in the spiritual life, that's no small thing. A few years after my encounter with Brother Dave, I accepted an invitation from a woman named Suzanne Stabile to speak at a conference she was hosting at Bright Divinity School. We instantly connected and knew that if left unsupervised by responsible adults, we could get into all kinds of trouble if we became friends. So, we became friends. When Suzanne told me our mutual friend Richard Rohr had been her spiritual mentor for years and had personally trained her in the Enneagram, I became curious and decided to attend one of her workshops. After an hour of listening to her lecture, I knew Suzanne wasn't just an Enneagram teacher. She was a ninja-level Mr. Miyagi from the Karate Kid kind of Enneagram teacher. To my good fortune, Suzanne picked up where Brother Dave had left off in my life years earlier, kindly taking me on the next leg of my journey toward understanding and applying the wisdom of the Enneagram to my life as a Christian. Many of the insights and anecdotes on these pages were taken from Suzanne's lectures, while others come from my own life and from what I have learned over the years by attending workshops and studying countless books by renowned Enneagram teachers and pioneers, such as Russ Hudson, Richard Rohr, Helen Palmer, Beatrice Chestnut, Roxanne Howe Murphy, and Lynette Shepherd, to name a few. More than anything, however, this book is the product of my and Suzanne's deep affection and respect for one another. It's the only way we know how to throw our two cents of experience and knowledge toward the effort to create a kinder, more compassionate world. We hope it succeeds. And if it doesn't, well, we still had a blast doing it. Now, to be clear, I am not a foamy-mouthed Enneagram zealot. I do not stand uncomfortably close to people at cocktail parties and tell them I was able to guess their Enneagram number based on their choice of footwear. People who do that are an evil begging to be overcome. But even if I'm not a fanatic, I am a grateful student. To borrow a quote from the British mathematician George Box, all models are wrong, but some are useful. That's how I see the Enneagram. It isn't infallible or inerrant. It is not the be-all and end-all of Christian spirituality. At best, it is an imprecise model of personality, but it's very useful. That said, here's my advice. If you find that this book supports you on your spiritual path, well, great. If not, don't throw it away. Put it on your bookshelf instead. It might come in handy one day. Life hands us a challenging syllabus. We need all the help we can get. Chapter 2, Finding Your Type. Neuroscientists have determined the brain's dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is associated with decision-making and cost-benefit assessments. If MRI brain scans had been performed on my friends and me one summer's night when we were 15, they would have revealed a dark spot indicating a complete absence of activity in this region of our brains. That particular Saturday night, a group of us got the brilliant idea that streaking a golf banquet at an exclusive country club in my hometown of Greenwich, Connecticut, was a wise decision. Other than certain arrest for indecent exposure, there was only one problem. Greenwich isn't a big town, and it was likely someone we knew would recognize us. After several minutes of deliberation, we decided our friend Mike should run home and return with ski masks for each of us. And so, at roughly 9 p.m., on a warm August night, six naked boys in ski masks, several of which were adorned with pom-poms, sprinted like startled gazelles through a beautiful oak-paneled room full of bankers and heiresses. The men clapped and cheered for us while the bejeweled women sat frozen in shock. We had hoped for the opposite reaction, but there was not ample time to stop and express our disappointment. And that would have been the end of it, if it weren't for my mother. "What did you and the guys do last night?" she asked the next morning as I walked into the kitchen and rummaged through the fridge. "Not much. We hung out at Mike's and then crashed around midnight." My mother is normally chatty, so I was a little puzzled when she didn't ask how my friends were doing or what my plans were for the rest of the day. I instantly had an uneasy feeling. "What did you and Dad do last night?" I said brightly. "We went as guests of the Dorfmans to their club's golf banquet," she replied in a tone that was one part sugar, one part steel. Now, most people don't ever anticipate that a sudden change in cabin pressure might occur in their home, triggering the hope that an oxygen mask would fall from somewhere overhead to replace the air that shock has just sucked out of their lungs. "A ski mask," she demanded, her voice rising as she strolled toward me like an angry Irish cop patting his truncheon in the palm of his hand. "A ski mask!" The tip of her nose was no more than an inch from my own. "I could pick your scrawny butt out of a lineup in the dark," she whispered menacingly. I tensed, wondering what was coming next. But the storm passed as abruptly as it rolled in. My mother's face relaxed into a sly grin. She turned on her heels and said over her shoulder as she walked out of the kitchen, "You're lucky your father thought it was funny." This was not the first time I wore a mask to protect myself. Far from it. Human beings are wired for survival. As little kids, we instinctually place a mask called personality over parts of our authentic self to protect us from harm and make our way in the world. Made up of innate qualities, coping strategies, conditioned reflexes, and defense mechanisms, among lots of other things, our personality helps us know and do what we sense is required to please our parents, to fit in and relate well to our friends, to satisfy the expectations of our culture, and to get our basic needs met. Over time, our adaptive strategies become increasingly complex. They get triggered so predictably, so often, and so automatically that we can't tell where they end and our true natures begin. Ironically, the term personality is derived from the Greek word for mask. You know, the word persona, reflecting our tendency to confuse the masks we wear with our true selves, even long after the threats of early childhood have passed. Now we no longer have a personality. Our personality has us. Now, rather than protect our defenseless hearts against the inevitable wounds and losses of childhood, our personalities, which we and others experience as the ways we predictably think, feel, act, react, process information, and see the world, limit or imprison us. Worst of all, by over-identifying who we are with our personality, we forget or lose touch with our authentic self, the beautiful essence of who we are. As Friedrich Buechner so poignantly describes it, the original shimmering self gets buried so deep that most of us end up hardly living out of it at all. Instead, we live out all the other selves, which we are constantly putting on and taking off like coats and hats against the world's weather. Though I'm a trained counselor, I don't know exactly how, when, or why this occurs, only that this idea of having lost connection with my true self rings true with my experience. How many times, while spying my children play, or while gazing up at the moon in a reflective moment, have I felt a strange nostalgia for something or someone I lost touch with long ago? Buried in the deepest precincts of being, I sense there's a truer, more luminous expression of myself, and that as long as I remain estranged from it, I will never feel fully alive or whole. Maybe you have felt the same. The good news is, we have a God who would know our scrawny butt anywhere. He remembers who we are, the person He knit together in our mother's womb. And He wants to help restore us to our authentic selves. Is this the language of the therapeutic under the guise of theology? No. Great Christian teachers from Augustine to Thomas Merton would agree that this is one of the vital spiritual journeys apart from which no Christian can enjoy the wholeness that is their birthright. As Merton put it, before we can become who we really are, we must become conscious of the fact that the person who we think we are, here and now, is at best an imposter and a stranger. Becoming conscious is where the Enneagram comes in. The goal of understanding your Enneagram type or number, the terms are used interchangeably in this book, is not to delete and replace your personality with a new one. Not only is this not possible, it would be a bad idea. I mean, you need a personality or you won't get asked to prom. The purpose of the Enneagram is to develop self-knowledge and learn how to recognize and disidentify with the parts of our personalities that limit us so we can be reunited with our truest and best selves, that pure diamond blazing with the invisible light of heaven, as Thomas Merton said. The point of it is self-understanding and growing beyond the self-defeating dimensions of our personality, as well as improving relationships and growing in compassion for others. The personality types. The Enneagram teaches that there are 9 different personality types in the world, one of which we naturally gravitate toward and adopt in childhood to cope and feel safe. Each type or number has a distinct way of seeing the world and an underlying motivation that powerfully influences how that type thinks, feels, and behaves. Now, if you're like I was, you'll immediately object to the suggestion that there are only 9 basic personality types on a planet of more than 7 billion people. Now listen, a single visit to the paint aisle at Home Depot to help an indecisive spouse find that perfect red for the bathroom walls might quell your remonstrations. As I recently learned, there are literally an infinite number of variations of the color red from which you can select to brighten your bathroom and wreck your marriage at the same time. In the same way, though we all adopt one and only one of these types in childhood, there are an infinite number of expressions of each number, some of which might present in a similar way to yours, and many of which will look nothing like you on the exterior. But you are still variations of the same primary color. So don't worry. Your mom didn't lie. You are still her special little snowflake. The Enneagram takes its name from the Greek words for 9, ennea, and for a drawing or figure, gram. It is a 9-pointed geometric figure that illustrates 9 different but interconnected personality types. Each numbered point on the circumference is connected to 2 others by arrows across the circle, indicating their dynamic interaction with one another. I've listed the names and a quick description of each Enneagram number. For the record, no personality type is better or worse than another. Each has its own strengths and weaknesses, and none is gender biased. Type 1, the perfectionist. Ethical, dedicated, and reliable, they are motivated by a desire to live the right way, improve the world, and avoid fault and blame. Type 2, the helper. Warm, caring, and giving, they are motivated by a deep need to be loved and needed, and to avoid acknowledging their own needs. Type 3, the performer. Success-oriented, image-conscious, and wired for productivity, they are motivated by a need to be, or appear to be, successful and to avoid failure. Type 4, the romantic. Creative, sensitive, and moody, they are motivated by a need to be understood, experience their oversized feelings, and avoid being ordinary. Type 5, the investigator. Analytical, detached, and private, they are motivated by a need to gain knowledge, conserve energy, and avoid relying on others. Type 6, the loyalist. Committed, practical, and witty, they are worst-case scenario thinkers who are motivated by fear and the need for security. Type 7, the enthusiast. Fun, spontaneous, and adventurous, they are motivated by a need to be happy, to plan stimulating experiences, and to avoid pain. And type 8, the challenger. Commanding, intense, and confrontational, they are motivated by a need to be strong and avoid feeling weak or vulnerable. And finally, type 9, the peacemaker. Pleasant, laid back, and accommodating, they are motivated by a need to keep the peace, merge with others, and avoid conflict. So maybe now you're starting to get an idea of which of the 9 types you belong to, or which one explains your 70-year-old uncle who still dresses up like Yoda and, attends Star Wars conventions. But the Enneagram is more than just a piddling list of clever type names, so that's just the beginning. In the following chapters, we're going to learn not only about each number in turn, but also about how those numbers relate to others. Don't be discouraged if the terminology seems confusing right now. I promise it will make sense to you in short order. A humble self-knowledge is a surer way to God than a search after deep learning. Thomas A. Kempis. Triads. The 9 numbers on the Enneagram are divided into 3 triads. 3 in the heart or feeling triad, 3 in the head or fear triad, and 3 in the gut or anger triad. Each of the 3 numbers in each triad is driven in different ways by an emotion related to a part of the body known as a center of intelligence. Basically, your triad is another way of describing how you habitually take in, process, and respond to life. The anger or gut triad is made up of the numbers 8, 9, and 1. These numbers are driven by anger. 8 externalizes it, 9 forgets it, and 1 internalizes it. They take in and respond to life instinctually, or at the gut level. They tend to express themselves very honestly and directly. The feeling or heart triad is made up of the numbers 2, 3, and 4. These numbers are driven by feelings. 2s focus outwardly on the feelings of others. 3s have trouble recognizing their own or other people's feelings. And 4s concentrate their attention inwardly on their own feelings. They each take in and relate to life from their heart and are more image conscious than other numbers. And finally, the fear or head triad is made up of the numbers 5, 6, and 7. These numbers are driven by fear. 5 externalizes it. 6 forgets it, and 7 internalizes it. They take in and relate to the world through the mind. They tend to think and plan carefully before they act. Now let me say something about the chapter order. If you look at the table of contents, you will notice we have chosen not to describe the types in numerical order, but to group and discuss them in the context of their respective triads. 8, 9, and 1 are together, then 2, 3, and 4, and finally 5, 6, and 7. The reason we chose to order the chapters like this is to help you see the important ways in which each number compares to its fellow triadic roommates. If anything, this will not only make the Enneagram easier to understand, but also aid you in your search for your number. Wing, stress, and security numbers. One of the things I love about the Enneagram is that it recognizes and takes into account the fluid nature of the personality, which is constantly adapting as circumstances change. There are times when it's in a healthy space, times when it's just in an okay space, or times when it's downright nuts. The point is, it's always moving up and down on a spectrum, ranging from healthy to average to unhealthy, depending on where you are and what's happening. At the beginning of each chapter, I'll briefly describe in broad terms how each number typically thinks, feels, and acts when they're camped out in a healthy, average, and unhealthy space within their type. Each number has a dynamic relationship with 4 other numbers, and each number touches the 2 on either side, as well as the two at the other end of the arrows. These four other numbers can be seen as resources that give you access to their traits, or juice, or flavor, as I like to say. While your motivation and number never change, your behavior can be influenced by these other numbers, so much so that you can even look like one of them from time to time. As you'll hear in each chapter, you can learn to move deliberately around the circle, using these for extra support as needed. Wing numbers. Now, wing numbers. These are the numbers on either side of your number. You may lean toward one of these two wing numbers and pick up some of its characteristic energy and traits. For example, my friend Doran is a 4, the romantic, with a 3 wing, the performer. He is more outgoing and more inclined to perform for recognition than a 4 with a 5 wing, that's the investigator, who is more introverted and withdrawing. Okay, so now let's talk about stress and security numbers. Your stress number is the number your personality moves toward when you are overtaxed, under fire, or in the paint aisle at Home Depot with an equivocating friend or partner. It's indicated by the arrow pointing away from your number on the Enneagram. For example, normally happy-go-lucky 7s move toward and take on the negative qualities of the 1, the perfectionist, in stress. They can become less easygoing and adopt more black and white thinking. It's important for you to know the number that you go to in stress so that when you catch it activating, you can make better choices and take care of yourself. Your security number indicates the type your personality moves toward and draws energy and resources from when you're feeling secure. It is indicated by the arrow pointing toward your number on the Enneagram. So, for example, 7s take on the positive qualities of 5 when they're feeling secure. That means they can let go of their need for excess and embrace the notion that less is more. Spiritually speaking, it's a real advantage to know what happens to your type and the number it naturally goes to in stress. It's equally valuable to learn the positive qualities of the number you instinctively move toward in security as well. Once you become familiar with this material, you can know and catch yourself when you're heading in the direction of a breakthrough or a breakdown, and make wiser choices than in the past. There's a lot to this topic of security and stress, but because this book is a primer, we'll only cover the basics. For now, just know there's a whole lot more to learn about it. Discover your deadly sin. It may sound like something from a medieval morality play, but each number has a deadly sin associated with it. And in each chapter, Suzanne and I will be diving deeper into what that looks like. Now look, I know, for some people the word sin evokes terrible memories and feelings. Sin, as a theological term, has been weaponized and used against so many people that it's hard to address the subject without knowing you're possibly hurting someone who has stood on the wrong end of the preacher's barrel, so to speak. But look, as a weathered sinner and a recovering alcoholic with 28 years of sobriety, I personally know that not facing the reality of our darkness and its sources is a really, really bad idea. Trust me, if you don't, it will eventually come out of your paycheck at the end of the month. Bearing sensitivities in mind, allow me to offer a definition of sin I have found helpful and one we might use together in our conversation. Richard Rohr writes, "Sins are fixations that prevent the energy of life, God's love, from flowing freely. They are self-erected blockades that cut us off from God and hence from our own authentic potential." Now look, as someone who goes to a church basement several mornings a week to meet with others who need support to stay away from just one of my many fixations and addictions, this definition rings true. We all have our preferred ways of circumventing God to get what we want. And unless we own and face them head on, trust me, they will one day turn our lives into nettled messes. Every Enneagram number has a unique passion or deadly sin that drives that number's behavior. The teachers who developed the Enneagram saw that each of the 9 numbers had a particular weakness or temptation to commit one of the 7 deadly sins drawn from the list Pope Gregory composed in the 6th century, plus fear and deceit. Along the way, a wise person added these last two, which is kind of nice because now no one needs to feel left out. Each personality's deadly sin is like an addictive, involuntarily repeated behavior that we can only be free of when we recognize how often we give it the keys to drive our personality. Now listen, again, don't think the term deadly sin sounds too early Middle Ages to still be relevant. It's timeless and important wisdom. As long as we are unaware of our deadly sin and the way it lurks around unchallenged in our lives, we will remain in bondage to it. Learning to manage your deadly sin rather than allowing it to manage you is one of the goals of the Enneagram. There are other personality typing systems or inventories like the Myers-Briggs or the 5-factor test that are wonderful, but exclusively psychological in orientation. There are others that describe and encourage you to embrace who you are, which isn't very helpful if who you are is a jerk. Regardless, only one of these instruments addresses the fact that we are spiritually mottled creatures. The Enneagram is not exclusively psychological, nor is it feel-good, self-help pabulum when taught correctly. By the way, if myself could have helped myself, don't you think myself would have done it by now? The true purpose of the Enneagram is to reveal to you your shadow side and offer spiritual counsel on how to open it to the transformative light of grace. Coming face to face with your deadly sin can be hard. It's even painful because it raises to conscious awareness the nastier bits about who we are that we'd rather not think about. No one should work with the Enneagram if what they seek is flattery. But no one should fail to do so if what they seek is deep knowing of self, as David Benner cautions. So, bravely on, friends. Here's a list of the 7 deadly sins, plus 2, and the number to which each correlates, as well as a brief description of them. The descriptions are drawn from Don Riso and Russ Hudson's book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram. The deadly sin of ones is anger. Ones feel a compulsive need to perfect the world, keenly aware that neither they nor anyone else can live up to their impossibly high standards. They experience anger in the form of smoldering resentment. The deadly sin of twos is pride. Twos direct all their attention and energy toward meeting the needs of others while disavowing having any of their own. Their secret belief that they alone know what's best for others and that they're indispensable reveals their prideful spirit. The deadly sin of threes is deceit. Threes value appearance over substance. Abandoning their true selves to project a false, crowd-pleasing image, threes buy into their own performance and deceive themselves into believing they are their persona. The deadly sin of fours is envy. Fours believe they are missing something essential, without which they will never be complete. They envy what they perceive to be the wholeness and happiness of others. The deadly sin of fives is avarice. Fives hoard those things they believe will ensure they can live an independent, self-sustaining existence. This withholding ultimately leads to their holding back love and affection from others. The deadly sin of sixes is fear. Forever imagining worst-case scenarios and questioning their ability to handle life on their own, sixes turn to authority figures and belief systems rather than God to provide them with the support and security they yearn for. The deadly sin of sevens is gluttony. To avoid painful feelings, sevens gorge themselves on positive experiences, planning and anticipating new adventures, and entertaining interesting ideas. Never satisfied, the seven's frenzied pursuit of these distractions eventually escalates to the point of gluttony. The deadly sin of eights is lust. Eights lust after intensity. It can be seen in the excessiveness they evidence in every area of life. Domineering and confrontational, eights present a hard, intimidating exterior to mask vulnerability. And finally, nines. The deadly sin of nines is sloth. For nines, sloth refers not to physical, but to spiritual laziness. Nines fall asleep to their own priorities, personal development, and responsibility for becoming their own person. It is my belief no man ever understands quite his own artful dodges to escape from the grim shadow of self-knowledge. Joseph Conrad. The Nine Types in Childhood. It's staggering to think how many messages our uncritical minds and hearts pick up and internalize in childhood, and how many hours and dollars we later